You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today.
Let's start. Dear colleagues, participants of the Effective Statisticians Conference, I'm really excited. We'll speak about the learnings from emulating randomized trials with data from clinical practice, which is a highly relevant topic. And by certain emulations, we can enhance our understanding of treatment effectiveness in diverse settings. His credentials speak for themselves. As an expert, he's a professor of medicine and epidemiology at Harvard Medical School and chief of the Division of Pharmacoepidemiology and Pharmaeconomics at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He is also a PI of the FDA CDAP-funded Sentinel Innovation Center. He is a voting consultant to the FDA Drug Safety and Risk Management Advisory Committee and a co-founder of Acheon Incorporated. His work centers on comparative effectiveness and safety of biopharmaceuticals, developing analytical methods for epidemiologic analysis using complex longitudinal healthcare databases. At Harvard, he teaches courses on database analytics for pharmacoepidemiology and effectiveness research in longitudinal healthcare databases. I'm really excited to hear his presentation. Dear participants, you will see the Q&A part in the Zoom channel. If you have any questions, please write them down there. If they are relevant to the slides that Sebastian is presenting at that particular moment, I will interrupt Sebastian, ask the question so that we can get the natural flow of the discussion. Having said that, welcome, Sebastian. Really looking forward to your presentation. The screen is yours.
Thank you very much for this warm introduction. I share, and you should be seeing my slides now in full screen mode. Do you see it?
Thank you.
Okay, perfect. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you, and I'm happy to be interrupted for any questions. As Richard already said, here's my disclosure. The typical funding is that I have equity in Acheon Inc., a software-enabled healthcare analytics company. I want to touch on 5 points. We have some preliminaries, and I go pretty fast through the preliminaries. We have 45 minutes together for me talking, and then we have 50 minutes of Q&A, or as I said, in between questions. Then what's the motivation for trial emulation, for actual trial emulation, not hypothetical trial emulation? Then the learnings from a project that was FDA-funded, RC Duplicate, some more learnings from RCTs with regard to real-world evidence of pharmacoepidemiology, which I take interchangeably, and then some considerations about next steps. What does this whole thing mean for real-world evidence? This is a warm-up here, a few slides. Real-world evidence really took off with the 21st Century Cures Act in 2016, where Congress mandated FDA to think about what they want to do with non-randomized studies that are based on data from the routine operation of the healthcare system, which they called real-world data. If you analyze real-world data to understand the effectiveness of medical products, that is called real-world evidence. They've posted these terms quite publicly in this framework document in 2018, which is why I think certainly from the North American perspective, we will be stuck with those terms, real-world data and real-world evidence, for a while, since they're embraced now by our key agency. And after 5 years in 2021, FDA came out with a whole slew of guidance documents for industry. And as you all know, These are documents that are taken quite serious. And then 2023, there was another guidance on external control arm. So it's a very active space in the US as well as in Europe and in Japan. There are very similar movements as well in mainland China, around the world, really, and trying to understand how far can you push real-world evidence results for decision-making. FDA leadership came up with this publication, Pharmacopeia and Drug Safety, last year, outlining the use cases for real-world evidence from a regulatory perspective. The HTA perspective, Health Technology Assessment Agency perspective, is very similar to this, maybe a little bit broader than these use cases. I highly recommend pulling up this paper and studying that if you're in that space. Often we work with insurance claims data, and what bullet point B is what the typical patient looks like in a claims database. You have a hospital stay, you have diagnostic information, visit with diagnostic information, prescription drug dispensing. You have a longitudinal record of all encounters with the professional healthcare system together with diagnostic, procedural, and pharmacy dispensing information. In that data stream, you implement an etiologic study, a causal study, which often is a cohort study with a cohort entry date. You look forward for the follow-up and look backwards in order to assess the patient health status. Now, what you also have is electronic health records, which you then link to the claims data backbone. We get the continuity and the chronology, the certainty about the chronology from claims data, particularly in the U.S., and the granularity from the electronic health record database. The U.S. is quite a fragmented healthcare system, and you never know when you look at the electronic health records as much granular information that they have. You never know where they have the complete information, which is why the combination of both claims data as well as electronic health record databases or other registry data is probably what we really want to have in the long run. Here's an example of an actual trial emulation, the RELY trial. This is the Bicatran, a directly acting oral anticoagulant with regard to stroke prevention in patients with atrial fibrillation. The trial found a reduction in the risk of stroke by 34% compared to warfarin. Years later, we emulated this trial in SPIRIT and similarly found a 25% reduction in the risk of stroke, that the incidence rates are lower than in the trial, which is, of course, on the trial side, you have enrichment strategies to enrich in patients with high risk of stroke. On the right side, you have, as things play out in clinical practice. Already, you see how real-world evidence analyses can complement the findings from randomized controlled trials. Another example, this is in the space of hypertension. Telmisartan is an estrogen receptor blocker compared to ranibril, an ACE inhibitor, in the OnTarget trial, trying to demonstrate non-inferiority of those two agents when it comes to cardiovascular events. The trial showed that a non-inferior ramipril versus telmisartan, the hazard ratio is 1.0. Then you see on the right side the emulation of that randomized trial in claims data, and we find similar findings equally supporting non-inferiority. Now we pushed this field a little bit harder. We knew that the Carolina trial was ongoing. Carolina was comparing linagliptin versus glimepiride, two agents to treat diabetes. We were emulating the design as closely as we could in claims data on the left side of this figure. The FDA motivated the Carolina trial because they were concerned about an increase in the risk of cardiovascular events, of MACE events. We concluded 6 months before the Carolina trial was completed that there's no difference in the risk for cardiovascular events between linagliptin and glimepiride. However, we thought that linagliptin has a much lower rate of hypoglycemic events. The Carolina trial was unveiled at the American Diabetes Association in San Francisco. It showed exactly the same. There's no difference in MACE, and there's a substantial benefit of linagliptin versus glimepiride when it comes to avoiding hypoglycemic events. This is a prediction of an ongoing randomized controlled trial. Here is an emulation of a trial point exposure in patients with a myocardial infarction. It's thrombus aspiration as a procedure in your coronaries. It's a one-time intervention. It's the TACE trial, finding no difference between the intervention and no intervention. And the emulation by Anthony Matthews from Karolinska found exactly the same using the SWEDEHEART registry in Sweden. Tougher challenge is when you compare users of a drug versus non-users, the risk of dying or MI in patients using beta blocker after MI versus not using beta blocker after MI, and you see some similar protective effect of this strategy. But the randomized trial didn't find any difference here. That is the challenge when you have a non-user comparison group. We talk about this all the time. In contemplating a randomized trial, the workhorse randomized trial is the parallel group randomized control trial, where you have some sort of washout or run-in phase for randomization, and then patients are randomized into the treatment group, exposed group, experimental group, what have you, versus a comparator, and sometimes that can be a placebo for regulatory purposes. The emulation thereof is the cohort study. You can emulate exclusions. You have S for selection rather than R for randomization. And then you have the two arms, exposed versus comparator. Clearly, we need to worry about the lack of baseline randomization, but we also need to worry about measurement issues as we work with secondary data rather than with primary data as the randomized trial does. We have also complex treatment strategies where there is then more bifurcations of the treatment strategy. We are not going to talk about that. We talk about simple treatment strategies on the left side. And on the right side here, you see this little table where you write down the trial. And this is not a hypothetical target trial. In our examples, these are actual trials. So we know exactly the eligibility criteria, treatment strategies, and so on. And the right column, then you write down how you plan to emulate this trial, this actual trial, in the data that you have available. And you will realize very quickly that some of the measurements are a real challenge with secondary data. And sometimes some of the design aspects are a challenge and cannot really be replicated in clinical practice. And we talk about that. Now, this is food for thought here. Bill Shadish, a statistician, published in JASA, one of these journals, more Greek than Latin letters, but it's a very applied paper. I really encourage you to read that. Basically showed that if you have perfect measurement of exposure, outcome, and confounding factors, you get the same findings as the randomized controlled trial, whether you randomize or whether you don't randomize. And he randomized students to a randomized trial versus a non-randomized study. And when the randomized trial, of course, there was further randomization into math training versus vocabulary training. And here there was self-selection into math training, vocabulary training. And as I said already, after some adjustment for the observed baseline characteristics, what was the math skill, what was the vocabulary skill before the intervention, the findings were exactly the same. So this is pointed toward data quality really matters. Now, let's go ahead and think about what motivates us to do trial emulation. And when I say trial emulation, a trial had been done or is ongoing, and we are emulating that one. The elephant in the room when you talk about non-randomized database studies is always, can be fully controlled confounding? Are we suffering from some misclassification problem that will bias our findings? In order to deflate any of these arguments, you need to compare to the true causal relationship of the treatment to the outcome. Where do you find that true causal treatment effect? Can we ever know the true causal treatment effect in a given population? The best thing we have is comparing to an actual randomized controlled trial, because a well-done randomized trial lends itself to causal interpretations. But you have to make sure it's in the same population as the database study we are comparing against. If there happened to be a well-conducted RCT that is identical in the design and in the measurements as a given real-world evidence study, would we not hope to see the same finding? Confirming the similarity or dissimilarity in findings would be of great value to understand whether and when real-world evidence studies can come to causal conclusions like a randomized controlled trial. All right? So we are clearly not saying that every real-world evidence study should be calibrated against a randomized trial, because that would be stupid, right? The trial gives us the answer already. This is really only about benchmarking and seeing how well we perform doing these non-randomized studies with secondary healthcare data for clinical practice. Now, we are comparing RCTs versus real-world evidence and want to see whether there's a difference or whether they're similar. Now, when you look at comparing real-world evidence study to real-world evidence study, there's actually some variability. There is Shirley Wang published a paper where she identified 150 published database studies in top journals using 4 or 5 databases that we also had available to us. And she was rerunning the same instruction set that was given in the publication and in any online materials. And in theory, she should get exactly the same because she used the same data and instructions reading the method section. But it turns out the correlation is only 0.85. You see these red dots, these are outliers, the 10 worst outliers. When you look at the published report, that there was a lack of clarity and completeness in telling us what exactly the authors had done. I don't think they did anything wrong or we did anything wrong. It was just a miscommunication. So there is room for improvement in letting our audience know what exactly have we done, because right now there is no guarantee that we get the same findings given the way real-world evidence studies are reported. So there's room for improvement here. But there's variability if you compare real evidence to real-world evidence. Now, if you compare RCT to RCT, there's also variability. Remember aducanumab from Biogen, this medication to reduce the cognitive decline in patients with Alzheimer's. They had designed 2 randomized trials, study 301 and 302. In the way I read them, they were exactly the same design, exactly the same eligibility criteria, and everything exactly the same. Nevertheless, one study found no difference in the MMSE. There's absolutely no difference here between the 2 treatment groups. But 302 did show a substantial improvement by 18 percentage points on the MMSE scale, whatever that exactly means. How can it be that equally designed randomized trials get quite different findings? I always say that we want to emulate well-conducted randomized control trials. And sometimes things go wrong. TopCat is an example of a randomized trial, and the PIs of the study, Mark Pfeffer, was quite open about this, that in the study sites in Russia and in Georgia at that point in time, actually collected or identified patients who didn't have heart failure. The probability of having the outcome is way lower. These patients don't have heart failure compared to all the other sites of the TopCat trial. Things can go wrong even in randomized control trials. If we find inequalities in the results of the RCT versus real-world evidence, is the trial really representative of the real-world study? How variable are the RCT results? Did we fail to emulate the trial? Do we have a different population? Are we having different treatment pattern, different dose escalation and things like that? What about the follow-up duration? The adherence or persistence on treatment might be much lower in clinical practice than in a randomized controlled trial. But we really want to know, is there any bias operating within the real-world evidence study? Is there residual confounding? Is there differential surveillance acting? That is what we want to learn, but it's extremely difficult to disentangle bias from the emulation failure and from the variability that is inherent to any single RCT. So you see challenges already. Now, let's dive into the RCT duplicate project where we actually did randomized trial emulations. It's a family of studies aimed to understand and improve the validity of real-world evidence studies for regulatory decision-making. AIM-1 was the most important, where the learnings that we hoped to get, and it was FDA-funded, FDA wanted us to study whether had we replaced a randomized controlled trial with a single similarly designed real-world evidence study, would we have come to the same regulatory decision? As you can see, it's a very regulatory perspective because it was funded by the FDA and the FDA researchers were involved in doing the study. In order to study this, we identified 30 RCTs that were designed to be submitted to regulators. We also identified 7 ongoing randomized trials where we didn't know the findings. We developed a process of how to do that, and then we wanted to study the factors that are likely predicting the result of the success of the emulation or not. Now, some key aspects of how we did this, we used 3 US-based claims databases, screened hundreds of randomized controls, and rejected most of them, usually because of measurement issues. The 30 plus 7 trials that we identified, they are not a random sample. They're highly selected in a sense that we thought we can do well in emulating the measurements and design of these trials. No claim of representativeness whatsoever. We did one-to-one propensity score matching, usually with more than 100 pre-exposure variables. The RCTs estimate the average treatment effect, Since we did one-to-one propensity score matching, we estimated the average treatment effect in the treated. We don't think that's a big issue. The RCTs estimated intention to treat, and none of them reported per protocol. Now, in real-world evidence studies, because of the issue of non-adherence or short persistence, we opted to go for the per protocol causal contrast. If you assume that in the randomized trial, adherence is almost perfect, and I should say, because these were trials submitted to the regulatory agencies, and everybody knows that if adherence is a problem, these trials will not be accepted. The adherence was extraordinarily high in all of these trials. If adherence is perfect, then the ITT estimate is exactly the same as the per protocol estimate. So we assumed that in the randomized control trial, we also see the per protocol estimate, which is the same as the ITT, and hence it's fair to compare against the per protocol analysis in the real world evidence study. We have several predefined binary agreement statistics. The big learning here was no matter what single agreement statistic you pick, you will be unhappy. It's always a set of agreement statistics, not just a single one that you might be interested in. But you can read this all up in these publications. We use the Agion software platform to implement all these 37 trial emulations for scalability, reproducibility, and clarity. We select the patients in a reproducible way. We pick the comparison groups. We select the treatment strategy. We select the risk adjustment methodology. In this case, it was one-to-one propensity score matching rather than weighting. We do feasibility in diagnostics before we then post the statistical analysis plan to clinicaltrials.gov. This is all publicly available for all 37 trial emulations. Agion produces the report of the actual implementation. We press the button and everything is run. Everything is predefined here in close collaboration with the FDA, who reviewed the protocols before we deposited them at clinicaltrials.gov. The process was the whole trial selection on the left side here. I spoke about this briefly. Develop the statistical analysis plan, feasibility analysis, register, and then do actual analysis. Then comes a report. As soon as we had the beginnings of statistical analysis plan, we moved over to the platform in order to implement the study, in order to do feasibility counts. Now, what is interesting is that we shared the analytic platform, which is an online platform, with the FDA, so that the FDA could make their regulatory consideration. It can make changes to the analysis. They can say, in hindsight, we would have defined the outcome slightly differently or done inverse probability treatment weighting rather than one-to-one propensity score matching. We enable the regulator to work with the underlying data. In a randomized controlled trial, when you have an effective disclaim, you will need to submit your patient-level data to the FDA so that they can do reanalyses, and the European Medicines Agency is doing that now as well. We, as real-world evidence producers, I think we need to follow that and also be able to present the data to the regulator for any reanalyses. Now, but why don't I pause here? Any questions so far? This was a lot about preliminaries and design before we then dive into the findings of this.
Sebastian, I have no questions in the Q&A.
All right, perfect. Thank you. Then I just continue, but please do interrupt if you feel I'm going too fast here. Now, this is trials 1 through 11. There's a lot of trials for the management of diabetes. What you see here is the column with the RCT findings, some protective effects here, some beneficial effects, and some non-inferiority studies. You see the real-world evidence effect estimate, the adjusted one. That is what we compared against the RCT. You see the standardized difference between the real-world evidence estimate and the RCT estimate, and you see our agreement statistics. On the very right side, you see a qualitative assessment according to 7 criteria, whether we thought we did well in the emulation of the design and of the measurement. This assessment is independent of the closeness of the effect estimate. This is really just considering how well did we do in emulating the design and the measurements. Sometimes we had difficulties, we realized later on, in emulating the comparison group when there was a placebo comparison, for example. We have antiplatelet trials, Triton, Plato, and ESA React 5. We had patients with atrial fibrillation. These are anticoagulants, Aristotle, Rely, Rocket AF. anticoagulants for the treatment of VTE, the Einstein program, Recover, Amplify, Record 1. We had two trials in the hypertension space. You see the emulations here where we were quite happy with the emulation of design and measurements. Fractures, bisphosphonate trials, chronic kidney disease, heart failure, paradigm HF, asthma and COPD. And for a variety of reasons, and they're all different reasons, and we're going to talk about that, we felt less sure after we had actually implemented the real-world evidence study that we might have a problem in emulating the actual randomized control trial for a variety of reasons. Okay, so these are the seven ongoing trials where you see also in the diabetes space, Carolina, Great, Sepra, and Seoul. Prostate cancer, Pronouns, which is a safety trial, really the cardiovascular endpoint in this treatment. Buck in the treatment of VTE, Cobra AF, that's in treatment of atrial fibrillation versus VTE. We have put our predictors forward, except for the Seoul trial, which is still ongoing on our end. Three of the trials have been completed in the interim, and we did well in two trials, not so well in the Great trial. The other trials are still ongoing. All right. I think there's a question in the Q&A. Actually, I see it over here. There are usually differences between clinical practice treatment, RCT title control treatments. Would you use modeling on other methods to account for this? Excellent question, Cornelia. It did not. Basically, we also did not consider if you have an up titration, down titration, things like that. We could not emulate that in the real-world evidence study. So there is clearly one of those factors that would make us think that the emulation was not that strong if that would happen. Absolutely. This is how the results typically look. This is the example of the lead trial. This is liraglutide, one of the GLP-1 receptor agonists, against placebo to reduce MACE. So this was categorized as the emulation not being so done because it's hard to emulate a placebo. What we used as a placebo, however, was DPP-4 inhibitors, which we knew have no relationship with MACE endpoint from several randomized controlled trials. So they have the same indication, treating diabetes, reducing the blood sugar, but they act as a placebo with regard to the endpoint of interest, which is MACE. Which is the randomized controlled trials, the two upper lines here, black is placebo, blue is the liraglutide, the reduction in MACE. The trial emulation is on a lower level. The incidence rate of MACE is lower in clinical practice, but you see also that the differential is pretty much the same between the liraglutide, the red line here in clinical practice, versus DPP-4, which serves as our placebo when it comes to the MACE endpoint. Right? So you see this frequently in our emulations. Overall, when we put this all together, these are 32 trials, this JAMA publication of 2023. On the horizontal axis, the findings from our emulation log scale. And on the vertical axis, the trial finding. You would expect these dots to be all exactly on the diagonal, right? And they're clustering around the diagonal. What is that overall, the correlation is 0.8 of all these dots. Now, this wouldn't satisfy me. If this would be my final interpretation of what we have done, I would be unhappy with that and wasn't sure whether I could conclude with any conviction that the real evidence studies are doing just fine. I think I want to see a stronger correlation here. Let's dissect this and find out what are the differences. There's clearly a sex distribution difference, although the inclusion criteria was exactly the same. But we know that women are underrepresented in randomized controlled trials. And of course, we see exactly that in clinical practice. We have 50-50 roughly, while it's quite different in many of the randomized controlled trials. Although we had exactly the same age eligibility criteria, our sub-participants were much older on average than the trial participants. Again, this is the self-selection into trials and all the selection mechanisms that are not fully spelled out. Generally speaking, when doing all that, I learned more about randomized control trials than I ever wanted to know. For example, did you know that most trials have an exclusion criterion if the study investigator thinks that the patient doesn't survive the next 12 months. That makes perfect sense for competing risk issues and things like that. I would want to do that myself. But how do you operationalize that? How do you operationalize the prediction of a patient might be dying in the next 12 months? And how do I operationalize this in my emulation study using claims data or EHR data? There's a lot that is less precise in this whole evidence generation enterprise that we're in than we would like. And I think we need to acknowledge that. Now, here are two examples, Rocket AF and Paradigm HF, where on the left half of the table is the RCT, on the right side is the real world evidence. And what you focus on the incidence rate of the event, and I think for Rocket Everything it was stroke 1.7 versus 2.2 in the exposed or comparator. In the real world evidence, quite similar, 1.5, 2.4, right? So the incidence rates are quite similar. We had a very specific definition of the stroke event, and we call it green. This is a good emulation. Now, for the paradigm HF, where the outcome is heart failure hospitalization, look at the incidence rate, 21 versus 26 in the trial, and we had 46 and 44, double the incidence rate. Clearly, there were patients sneaking through our eligibility criteria who were not hospitalized because of the decompensation of heart failure. They had heart failure as a comorbidity, but it was not the main reason for hospitalization. And we mark that as a suboptimal emulation with regard to the measurement here. So you get the idea about the emulation quantity. There are other aspects that led us to think that there are certain emulation challenges. And in the end, we think it's not the age-sex differences, the difference in distribution of age and sex. And we did a reweighting exercise for age and sex, and there was no difference there. And it wasn't confounding either, at least not in a majority. There were other things that were problematic. For example, if the treatment starts in the hospital, you should know that in insurance claims data, you don't see the exact treatment in the hospital because hospitals are getting paid with a prospective payment. They get a lump sum of treating a certain condition, and it's up to them to do organize the treatment. Insurance doesn't know what exactly was done when it comes to treatment. Now, this is an example of a patient with a myocardial infarction. They get hospitalized and receive an antiplatelet agent right away. They get stented or whatever, and they get antiplatelet, either clopidogrel or prasugrel as part of this trial. I think it was Plato, or was it Triton 1? I think it was Plato. These are the trial findings. When you magnify what's happening at the very beginning, all the action is at the beginning. At the very beginning, you see the treatment effect, right? And then after that, the Kaplan-Meier plot, the survival plots, actually parallel. There's very little additional action. There's a little bit maybe, right? But overall, most of the action is at the very beginning. So it's all happening in the hospital. The treatment choice is happening in the hospital, as well as the early events, the re-infarctions happening in the same hospital. And we don't see that in our data. Hence, we see no beneficial effect, no big difference really between the two treatments, while the trials do see a difference. Okay? And so this is a design problem or a measurement problem. We cannot emulate the measurements because they're happening in the hospital. Another thing is that the persistence of treatment in clinical practice is much worse than randomized trials. And I do admire these randomized control trials, how they keep patients on treatment for this prolonged period of time. The example here is the Horizon Pivotal trial. This is zoledronic acid against placebo in patients with osteoporosis, and the outcome is hip fracture. So hip fracture we measure quite well, we thought. It's a major event, obviously. And zoledronic acid, I should say, is an intravenous infusion once a year. And what we saw is the bottom half here of this, the Kaplan-Meier, that after 12 months, nobody, except for, I don't know, 5 or 6 people, came back for a second infusion. There was no persistence on this treatment. It was a one-time issue. We gave them 6 more months of follow-up time because these bisphosphonates linger around and it takes a while for them to wear off. We basically stopped our follow-up time after 18 months because we felt nobody's exposed anymore. All right? But while the trial keeps on going, we are comparing the first 18 months against an experience over 36 months. It actually turns out that in the first 18 months, we get exactly the same point estimate as the first 18 months of the trial. However, there was treatment effect modification over time. The treatment effect was strengthened the longer you were on the treatment. You see the Kaplan-Meier is really diverging here further. And then overall, you see this 41% reduction in hip fracture, while we see only the 25% reduction. Okay? So here we have shorter follow-up in clinical practice paired with time-varying treatment effects. The treatment is getting stronger with longer duration, and that is biasing our overall findings. Not biasing, it makes it different. If you're studying something different, like on the left side, we're studying in clinical practice the effect of clopidogrel versus prasugrel after you have survived your index hospitalization. It's a different study question because we cannot emulate the trial really. The third example are the asthma and the COPD trials. And Sammy Suisa has published on that for the last 20 years already and highlighting that we didn't read his papers, unfortunately. We thought we can emulate these trials, but we can't. What happens in COPD, for example, often we're interested in comparing triple therapy versus dual therapy. These are inhaler medications where you combine inhalable corticosteroids plus LAMA plus LABA. These are all treatments to reduce inflammation and keep the bronchi open versus dual therapy, in this example, LAMA-LABA combination. That's a perfectly valid and important question. These trials had a run-in period where they observed the baseline therapy. And now here comes the kicker. In this baseline therapy, it turns out that almost 40% of subjects that were randomized were already on triple therapy. Now, if you get randomized to the dual therapy, what does that mean for those 40%? For those 40%, you take away the ICSLA, the inhalable corticosteroid, which of course makes the treatment group, the triple, look much better because you have a flawed takeaway trial. Taking something away that works makes the other group look better. In clinical practice, we don't take away what seems to work. So we could not emulate this study design, found no difference between dual and triple therapy in our study, while the takeaway trials, they found this 25% improvement in the treatment with triple versus dual therapy. I don't think that's relevant, this estimate, because it's a takeaway trial. That's not something that we do in clinical practice. All right? And again, that just makes it impossible for us to emulate these trials. Now, what you see here, and you look at the scatter plot again, they're color-coded, red dots and blue dots. The red dots are those trials where we had difficulty emulating them for all the reasons I just laid out. The blue dots were the trials where we felt we did a good job in emulating the trials. When you now look at the correlation coefficient in the blue dots, you see that jumps up to 0.94. And in my mind, now we're in business. I think that is the correlation that makes it very interesting with regard to the credibility of real-world evidence study being able to replicate trial findings. Now, here's one data point that makes me puzzled. This is a blue dot. We thought we emulated as well. It is far away from the diagonal. What is happening here? This is actually two studies, the Einstein DVT study, Einstein PE study. Both of them, we thought we emulated well. This is rivaroxaban and direct anticoagulant versus warfarin plus enoxaparin, which is a low molecular weight heparin for the treatment of VTE. The Einstein DVT is patients who were included because they had a DVT, and Einstein PE is including patients who had a more progradient DVT, which where the thrombus went up to the lung and caused a pulmonary embolism. The Einstein DVT, we emulated both well, we thought, but the findings are quite similar here, 0.68 versus 0.75. But in the Einstein PE, look at this, the trial showed actually a harmful effect, strictly speaking, a 12% increase in the risk of VTE in these patients, with some uncertainty, of course, but certainly didn't show a benefit as did the Einstein DVT. And we continue to see the benefit. And we now worry, what is going on with the Einstein PE? And we had several conversations with the people who did the trial. It's exactly the same setup, the same clinical sites in order to do the trial. This is one of those fluke things that I cannot explain. We looked at a meta-analysis of other trials in the same space, and they didn't see any treatment effect heterogeneity, whether these patients had DVT or PE. Rivaroxaban always worked in the same way, or the other DOAC that they used, Pixaban. There was no treatment effect heterogeneity between DVT and PE patients. Our conclusion is, and totally understand if you disagree with it, that there's something wrong with this trial. For whatever reason, there's this fluke finding. I would not give that much credence to this data point here. But it was all predefined, and we're not taking it back. This is what we found. I'm highly skeptical that this blue dot is really up here. It most likely is much more further down here, closer to the green, for the reason that I just gave you. With all those findings, we conclude that overall, if you have good measurements and you can emulate the design and the measurements of the trial, you can expect to get the same finding as the randomized controlled trial in your emulation claims and EHR data. All right? If you didn't learn anything new because the trials already showed you what the finding would be. What is the application really? It comes to studies of broadening the indication of already marketed medications. When you want to get a supplemental indication, you have your phase 2-3 program. You file your NDA to the FDA. This is a North American perspective here, but similarly in Europe, you enter the market. And after a while, you decide, I want to apply for supplemental indication for a slightly different population or for a different endpoint. Rather than lowering HbA1c for an antidiabetic medication, I want to show that I reduce the cardiovascular events. So you run another randomized controlled trial, and if that's successful, you submit your supplemental NDA. That's the classical approach to broadening indications. What you can contemplate is, once you're in the marketplace, you try to emulate your phase three trials in design and measurements. Your drug is now out in clinical practice and used, and you use whatever database, a claims database, as we have done with RCT duplicate, and emulate the trial. And if you find the same finding or close enough to the phase three trial findings, that's a huge confidence booster. Basically, you have demonstrated now that in your data and analytics setup, you can come to the same conclusion as the trial that you have emulated. So that is a huge confidence booster. And now in a second stage, what you do is expand the indication. You look at a different endpoint. You look at a broader population. You now include women in childbearing age, for example, who were excluded. You include old adults. You're broadening your population, okay? And then you submit your sNDA. Now, this strategy, which we call BenchXCal, exploring that, we're trying to validate this. We have a contract with the FDA. It's quite interesting, as it seems to me. I don't want to speak for them, where we do exactly this, the blue pathway, but we're picking examples where in real life, actually, it happened that there was a randomized controlled trial. What you basically do is you have your two estimates, your two remains unobserved in a real application, and you have some sort of divergence because theta 1 star, the emulation, is never exactly the same as theta 1. Your Xi 1 here is the divergence parameter. You take your real world estimate of your second stage and use Xi 1 as the divergence parameter rather than the unknown Xi 2. Then you can do sensitivity analysis around that. It's benchmarking, extrapolation is the green, and the calibration is the Xi parameter here in order to broaden indication. That's a real use case for pharma and regulators. Here's a worked example where Julian Kirschgesser was a fellow with us, who's now a professor in Paris, running a GI department and emulating two randomized trials, the SUCCESS trial and the SONIC trial in the IBD space, comparing infliximab versus tiopurines monotherapy, and was quite successful in that. Stage two, he studied what he really wanted to study, which was the combination therapy of vedolizumab together with thiopurines versus monotherapy. That is something that is unlikely to be ever done in a randomized controlled trial. There is no economic interest by pharma, and often the public funders are also not dealing out enough money to really do these trials. So far, we have not seen any of these trials. This is an application of this two-stage approach, BenchXCal. Other learnings from RCTs. Very briefly, we are running out of time here. I'm very skeptical about line programming. The reproducibility is highly error-prone. You rather want to focus on the study parameters that you can verbalize and use those study parameters to use a pre-programmed process. This is the FDA Sentinel program to run a cohort study, for example. Use platforms like the Agilent platform, where you have a very granular depiction of what is going on, very transparent. You have a study registration, something that randomized trials do all the time. I think real evidence should do the same. If you have effectiveness claims, you have audit trails, and you might want to share the data. So we are learning from RCTs. Why shouldn't we do the same as the randomized controlled trial, particularly when we have effectiveness claims? START RWE is a guidance document for academics with the representation from the regulators. This also led to a harmonized protocol template of how to do better study protocols for these types of studies. The literature is littered with nonsensical real-world evidence studies, and we're all aware of that. And reviewers are confused and feel uneasy to discern between good and bad real-world evidence studies. And we need to help them. When you look at the commentaries that we read from FDA, for example, in publicly available commentaries, how they interpret real-world evidence, I think they do a good job. They look for flaws, the typical biases in these non-randomized analysis of secondary data. Real-world evidence is not a shortcut to success. There are evaluation tools like Robin's Eye that very much follow the target trial. Framework is very helpful, and we published a study for reviewers familiar with evaluating randomized control trials, what is the added thing that you need to consider when you evaluate these secondary data analyses? And together with FDA, we came up with this principled framework and how to do and how to plan for these randomized control trials. Overall, real-world evidence will have more influence, increasing influence in regulatory decision-making or HTA decision-making as we follow the principles of causal inference. And as we reduce human error and increase transparency, and we know how to do that. We can learn that from randomized control trials. And as the data sources are improving, which they do rapidly, every week there's a new startup company about a new data asset. And often enough, it's not as what was promised, but the situation is getting only better when it comes to the data sources. And with that upbeat message for everybody, I will pause here and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. There's one question in the chat. Cornelia, could you comment on pragmatic randomized trials?
These are pragmatic elements in randomized controlled trials that we evaluate when submitted to the FDA. These are highly controlled trials where you have blinding, adherence, adjudication committees, all the bells and whistles to control the environment to get to an efficacy estimate. Now, you can loosen these things and introduce pragmatic elements. You can let the adherence play out as it is in real-world practice. You can not have adjudication committees, but rely on hospital records to assess the outcome. In that sense, these pragmatic randomized trials are in between highly controlled randomized trials versus real-world evidence studies. And it turns out that with our emulations, we do way better in emulating pragmatic randomized controlled trials than highly controlled. One main reason is in pragmatic randomized control trials, most of the time you don't have placebo. You have active comparator, and that makes it much easier to emulate.
Thank you, Sebastian. I don't see any open questions. I have two, actually, starting with one. From the trials that I saw that you emulated, I missed oncology trials, right? There was one prostate cancer trial, right? That was focused on the cardiovascular safety endpoint, I think. Is there a specific reason, or is there something you'd like to do in the future?
Richard, we were very pragmatic in order to do this. I think we were the first ones doing this as a large scale, these emulation things. And we had these databases available and thought, okay, cancer is not in these databases. So there was a pragmatic decision not to do cancer. We have a program ongoing now on CORE, which is FDA funded, where we do exactly the same for oncology, where we have now access to five oncology specialized EHR systems, where we have much more granular oncology data, where we emulate oncology trials across multiple data sources, across multiple cancers. There is a bit of a literature out there about trial emulation oncology, and there's good stuff out there already.
There is a question from Lewis, so I'll postpone my second question. In duplicate, you use only propensity score matching. What about the use and relevance of other causal inference methods, structural models, G methods, etc.? But emulating clinical trials.
Yeah, Lewis, two important points in this question. One is the structural models in G methods. When you have time-varying treatment for complex treatment strategies, but we had fairly simple treatment strategies. You get put on one or the other and take it as long as you can. So we didn't need to use structural models because we have such simple treatment strategies that we compare. You could argue whether we want to investigate the informative censoring, inverse probability of censoring weighting, as we have shown multiple times. It doesn't make any difference whether you do this or don't. The propensity score matching, which is the reason why we estimate ATT, average treatment amount treated, rather than ATE, is because in real-world evidence, when we have real-world data, the inverse probability of treatment weighting, which is the basis for G methods, have trouble sometimes if the data source is not perfect. Sometimes you have this extremely high weight in the extremes of the propensity score. We have seen this and demonstrated this multiple times because of misclassification. Clearly, these patients shouldn't be in these extremes. Yet IPDW is upweighting that. You truncate the weights, but then the whole interpretation of ATE is no longer valid because your population has changed. We can do propensity score matching right away, which is much more transparent and clearer in its conduct and appreciated by regulators. So there are statistical reasons as well as very pragmatic reasons for that choice.
There's several questions now. The next one is anonymous. Is the data from your ICT RWE study available to look at? I'm interested in your SAP.
Yes.
You did mention that it was publicly available. So maybe you can share where that is.
Exactly. So you go to the JAMA paper, the JAMA publication, you see the codes for registration numbers for clinicaltrials.gov. And there you find the statistical analysis, where you see all the boring details there, as well as plausibility analysis. It's all there.
Thank you, Sebastian. And the last question, how do you take into account things like colliders in propensity score matching for Lewis?
It's Lewis specialist causal inference. That's great. Variables that we selected were selected by investigators. This was not an automatic confounding adjustment procedure. Although we are doing this right now, and we find very similar findings, whether it is automatically or having the investigator. We basically rely on the investigator not to adjust for colliders. The other comment that I want to make about colliders is it's extremely hard in our field to find really meaningful and strong colliders that would really make a difference. And when you're not sure, even if you draw a DAG, whatever, whether it's a collider or a confounder, I would rather always adjust for it when in doubt. So in that sense, try to take care of the collider. If there is some fluke collider in there, I'm not worried about it for those reasons.
Okay, thank you very much. It is 4 o'clock on the dot. So with that, I would like to close this. There is another question. So a couple of other questions. Lewis agrees with your answer, so that's cool. We will have to stop now for people to allow to go to other sessions. So thank you very much. I'm sorry for innocent. The question has not been answered. Maybe I know that Sebastian can see it online, so he can maybe answer it.
Shoot me an email, send, or whoever has other questions, just send me an email.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, and have a great rest of the conference. Thank you, Sebastian, for a very comprehensive, great presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard, for handling this so well.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS for help with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.